Welcome to the Joe Cohen Show. Join me as I share my experience with biohacking and invite top health experts to explore the latest technology, supplements, research, and resources for optimizing your body and brain. Hey everyone, I'm really excited to have Dr. Ben Lynch on the podcast. He is an expert in genetics. He's been in the field for quite a while. He is the best-selling author of Dirty Genes and president of Seeking Health, a company that helps educate both the public and health professionals on how to overcome genetic dysfunction. He received his doctorate in naturopathic medicine from Bastyr University, and he also has a history in unexplainable health issues that he was able to discover the root cause of, dirty genes, as he calls them. And through this process, he's been able to overcome a bunch of health issues, life-threatening, some chronic health problems. And I brought him on the podcast here to discuss a variety of topics about genetics. And so super excited to have you on.
Awesome to be here, Joe.
Great. I guess let's get started on, I'm interested in your take on the state of the genetic industry right now.
Wow.
Loaded question, huh?
Yeah, let's just go right into it. The state of the genetic industry, first of all, it's a massive industry, and I don't follow it too closely outside of my niche. But I will say that CRISPR technology and AI, hospitals finally getting off their ass and looking at genetics for cancer, blood clot risk, warfarin, half-life, that's great. And I'm really happy that's happening. AI and genetics makes me a bit nervous because I've used AI and so has my son, where you ask it a question. My son was struggling in chemistry class and he was trying to do this problem. I said, just plug it into ChatGPT and see what it says. And he plugs it in and just writes all this stuff, and he gets the answer back and he reads it and goes, Dad, that's not right. I said, well, tell ChatGPT you're wrong. And he goes, really? I said, yeah. And he goes, you're wrong. And ChatGPT goes, oh, sorry, you're right. And rewrites all this crap and puts out the net response. And Theo looks at it and he goes, Dad, it's still wrong. I was like, sell it, it's still wrong, and give him your answer. And he does that. And he goes, oh, you're right. My confidence of ChatGPT is horrible. And I've also used ChatGPT for research purposes, thinking it might speed up my time for how it is. So digging for legitimate functional studies on genetic variations, it's mind-numbing, because so much stuff is in petri dishes or mice or what have you, and there's very few human good studies. And so I use ChatGPT to try to narrow that down, and it shows me some amazing responses, and then I check the PubMed IDs, and they're completely something different. ChatGPT, in my opinion, sucks.
I had the same experience, by the way. Yeah, we try to use it to speed up certain research processes, and the hit rate for like accurate references was like 25%.
Yeah, it's shocking. It was more of a waste of time. And it's actually, Joe, I would say most of my work is done in the past, not anymore, I'm over it. But in the past, I would be hearing a podcast or watch a YouTube video or hear something from some other expert. And then I would go to PubMed or somewhere to try to verify their information. And I was like, I have no idea where the hell they came up with this crap. They're saying that if you have MTHFR genetic variation, that you're 40% higher risk of having higher levels of mercury. I was like, what? And so my time was dedicated towards looking for information to either affirm or deny all this stuff that is being said on the internet. And I still to this day do it somewhat, but I'm doing it way less because I need to direct my information, my attention towards things where I'm really good and where my audience struggles. So I serve my audience, I serve my family and myself with my research. And so the state of the genetic industry, I would say it's an exciting time. It's still very new. And I will say, honestly, that I've been watching Self-Hacked, Self-Decode, and you for, God, what? How long has it been? It's been a long time since you've been around. What, 10 years
yeah.
now?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I would see you popped up after, what year was the first year that you started?
2013.
Yeah, 2013. That's about right.
2013, maybe 2014. Yeah.
Yeah. Because 2011, I launched mteachafar.net and I was super busy and doing all this stuff. And then, yeah, around 2014 or 15, I start seeing this Joe Cohen guy. And I was like, oh, this guy, he's actually seems knowledgeable. He actually seems like he's not talking out of his ass. And so, yeah, I watched you and then started, was years later that I got, actually, you and I started talking. And so I really love what you're doing with Self Decode. I think it's fantastic. And so, yeah, congratulations to that. And your team has done a fantastic job.
I appreciate that. And I appreciate you as a person as well, because I can see very quickly, just even by the way you're describing certain things, that I went through the same process, people citing something or 40% increased mercury, whatever it is. Then you try to look up the information and you see it's, wait, where are they getting this from? Do you have a reference? And that's why I always, whatever I do, whatever information we put out, I always say we have to make sure it's referenced. Where is this coming from? So that somebody who sees this can go to the source and verify that it's true. Because that's what I always do. And so I always make sure you have so much garbage information out there now, right?
Yeah.
And especially with the genetic testing too. What do you make of the consumer genetic? There's like a new company every day now.
There's a new company every day. They come and go. They're wringing the coffers of people until their audience gets pissed off or they get called out. There's some really big names out there that are serving up genetic information. I have no idea where the hell they came from. I'm not going to name any names. I don't do that. But it pisses me off. They charge a lot of money. Their information is fear-based. And their actions are usually swallow my pill that I made, my supplement. And I own a supplement company. And you have to be very careful in recommendations of supplements with genetic testing, because people think that if they have a genetic problem, and a genetic variation is not a problem, it's just you're identifying how your genes for you may function. It's not how they are functioning. And by you seeing that if you have the MTHFR genetic variation, for example, and I have the compound heterozygous, I have one copy of 677 and one of 1298. It's pretty significant.
Same with me, by the way. I'm also a compound heterozygous.
Yeah, it's, and I think, Joe, I think having an MTHFR enzyme like that has put a burden on us in our earlier years of life. And when we identify that and when we look at all the things that MTHFR is associated with and what its mechanisms are, and you're like, oh my God, this is pretty significant. But I will say that when I found that out for me back in 2011, the first thing I did was take methylfolate, because that's the gut reaction. The gut reaction is I have the MTHFR variation. Its job is to make methylfolate. And that's its only job, by the way, or to regulate the upstream amount of folate above as well. That's a secondary job. And so I took a bunch of methylfolate. First day I felt, oh my God, I felt amazing. This is great. I can think. I have energy. I'm in a good mood. Next day, I take it again. I've got so much energy. I'm a little on edge. And I'm taking 100 micrograms, by the way. And I was 800 micrograms plus a milligram of methylcobalamin. And it's our active B methylfolate lozenge is what I was taking. And next day, I took it again. Now I got a headache. And I'm a little bit irritable. Next, and I think I have to take this every day because I have MTHFR. And then the next day I take it again and my headache is worse. And I never, ever got headaches. And then I was just an asshole and I was impatient and I couldn't sit down and my head was really hurting. Next day I wake up, take it again. And then my head was really hurting and I was really pissed off. And finally, it was back in the day I had my home and I had maybe 100 feet of grass to walk across to go into my Home Depot shed was my office. And I was walking across, staring at the squirrels and the trees and the birds and just saying, God, my head hurts. And I think I literally stopped and I said, Ben, what changed? Because this is not you. You're not, you don't feel like this. You don't act like this. And God, your head doesn't feel like this. What changed? I was like, oh, I have empty Jafar. And you label yourself like that. I have empty Jafar. And then I took methylfolate consecutively every single day. I stopped taking it and I got myself back again. And these genetic reports that come out and they say that you have this gene and these people, and there's a red circle next to it or a yellow circle. And it says, oh, this is associated with X, Y, and Z problem. And you're like, oh, I have that. And I'm going to fix it by taking this supplement. And there's no lifestyle stuff. If there is, it's very basic. So I loathe these genetic reports. And yeah, I don't like the word H word, but I loathe many of them. I love yours, but I loathe others. Yours is the only one I recommend, actually. That's it.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, I'm somebody that I don't like having a product that is not, that isn't like really the best out there. And I actually started doing what some of these other companies were doing, to be very honest. And I realized that I met scientists that were like, it doesn't work like this. You have 100 million variants and you actually, if you want to, we have to validate this software as well with large biobanks if we really want to predict conditions in the future or at least show a tendency, right?
Yeah.
You're not going to necessarily get any of these things because their lifestyle has a huge impact on whether you get heart disease, diabetes, or any of these issues, right? But so I've raised a lot of money and I spent a lot of money in order to build the software to do it. And then I see just every day a new mom and pop coming up with something that can be built with $10,000 looking at a couple snips online. And you combine that with grandiose claims. And then people are like, wait, but I thought this was, I just paid $600 for this genetic test. And I tell people, look, unfortunately, it's not like, they're making like recommendations and a lot of them don't even have any references. I'm like, I don't even know where they're getting any of this stuff from.
Yeah.
It's like they give you a report and it's like, where are you getting this information from? It's like specific genetic variants. So what we did was we actually, by the time this is going to be out, it's already going to be published, but we were working a very long time on making sure that our algorithm was the best on the market. And the companies that we're actually competing with, you've never even heard of. Maybe you have or whatever, but they're companies that don't even have it to consumers. They're trying to get it in with the hospitals. And so our paper now is going to show, it's going to be released in about a week, that we looked at biobanks of 2 million people, and we show that we have the best predictive power for these polygenic risk scores.
Nice.
And now you can't make recommendations just based on a polygenic risk score. That was my issue as well. It's okay, we have this technology for polygenic risk scores, but you want as much inputs as possible. You want it to be as much multidimensional as possible, because for myself, what happens is I'll get a lab test, shows, okay, you have suboptimal levels of this or that. And then you're going to look at 100 million variants and do a different thing for each one, and then for each polygenic risk score, and then for each symptom and condition you have.
Yeah.
I already take a lot of supplements. What am I going to be doing?
Right. Good point. Yeah. Yeah.
So, but still here's where the interesting thing is. You still could pick specific genes like the MTHFR, like certain other ones that kind of help you explain the mechanism by which you might be at higher risk for certain conditions. So the polygenic risk score might help predict that overall condition, but you could see like certain genetic variants, like, hey, you might not be producing as much methylfolate here because of this. And if you're low on methylfolate, that could eventually lead to other conditions. And then you take that information with other information as well, including your homocysteine. Mm-hmm. And so you could see, and then you try to make as good of a picture, as good of a picture as you can. That's the way I look at it. Would you say that, how would you look at that?
I would say that looking at multiple genetic variations, i.e. polygenic, is extremely valuable. But like you say, what do you do with all this data when you are struggling with 13 different symptoms and you're getting polygenic risk scores possibly for every one of those symptoms? But you also, as a health professional, it's, and as just an individual, you need to step back and you need to start thinking, okay, I have difficulty falling asleep. I have itchy skin. I have IBS-like symptoms sometimes. I have difficulty breathing when I exercise heavily. I am more intolerant to seasonal pollutants and really struggle with cats and dogs at times. Okay, I got all these symptoms. And what are they all related to? They're all related to histamine. Okay, I need to lower histamine. Hold on. Why is your histamine levels? Why are they elevated? What do you mean? I have all these symptoms that are associated with high histamine. I'm just going to take a supplement that lowers histamine. But you can, and you're probably going to be on it the rest of your life. But what triggers histamine? Infections, stressors, hormone imbalances, chemicals, reduced ability for detoxification. These are to just name a few. And then you zoom back even more. Then you look at your immune polygenic score. Holy shit. Yeah, my immune system, when it sees an infection, it sends out the entire army. It doesn't just send out a scout. It just goes all in. And it was just, I took a bite of gluten. I know I'm supposed to be gluten-free, but I just took a bite and, oh my God, for 6 months, I was half comatose. Other people, they have a polygenic score in their immune system where they could have 15 different viruses in them and the strep throat, and they just feel a bit tired. That's it. Because their immune system is not being called into action to eradicate these things. So that's just one, that's one thing about how it's important to zoom out despite having a report in front of you. And when a report is in front of you, the first thing that you think about, A, it's official, B, it's information I've never seen before, and C, I'm going to trust this because I invested money in it. And it's new information, and it's approaching it from a new way that I've never done before either. So I'm going to give it a shot. And then you give it a shot, and it's so micro that it's like if you're shooting a bow and arrow at a target 50 feet away with your eyes closed. You might hit it. You might get lucky, and they might say that, oh, your polygenic risk score for histamine is this, and you do take a histamine-containing supportive supplement. And you do get benefit. The problem is you still have this underlying fatigue. You still have some brain fog. You still have your reduced ability to perform if you want to be an athlete. And you've lowered the histamine, but you still have the dysfunction going on. And so that is my biggest thing. And you liked what you showed me this morning when you showed me the latest things with Self-Decode, where you have a biohacker slider, where you show, and you said, you look at some specific topic and you present some information and you say, we as an organization limit the information that we present to people because it's so overwhelming. And my genetic report is 100 pages long and graphs and diagrams, and it's really confusing. And it's very few people that will dedicate time towards learning it. But if they do, they get so much more out of it. And the people who do toggle that biohacker switch to on, if they are committed, they are going to go down a huge rabbit hole and they are going to have headaches. And maybe their spouse is saying, come on, let's go, and getting in a fight later because they're so stuck into the research. But the effort that you put into understanding mechanisms of action and learning how genes communicate with each other and how the environment communicates with these genes, and you're able to assimilate that information and put it together, you are light years ahead than 99.9% of people.
I agree with that. For myself, I had 60 chronic health issues that I was able to get rid of, and it didn't go away over time, but the more I dived into the data, the more I've been able to get rid of one by one. And mm-hmm. My goal is to try to make it as simple as possible for people that don't have as much time and knowledge as me to go super deep into it, so that they don't have to be, super smart and like super dedicated, But even so, I still think, like, no matter what, it's just, it is a complex field. That's where the practitioners come on board. They can help. If you have a knowledgeable practitioner, they can help guide you about what to pay a little more attention to, what to pay a little less attention to, and try to put some things together. I want to get back to the MTHFR a little bit. People love MTHFR, and it is a significant gene, right?
Yeah.
Both me and you have it, so it's also interesting. Mm-hmm. Both the double, two of the risk alleles for the main one. So you mentioned that you got these headaches from the folate, right? The methylfolate. What do you think, in hindsight, that was from? And I guess the big age-old question is, that I always still get, is what do you do when you have MTHFR? What is the process that somebody is going to go through? And what do you recommend they do if they only have one of these genotypes? Because 40% of people are going to have one of them, and mm-hmm. they think they're dying a lot of times. Yeah. I got one of them. Am I going to make it?
All their symptoms on it.
Exactly. So how do you go about, let's wrap up the MTHFR. How do you go about taking care of the MTHFR story if somebody has that one?
The first question you have to ask is, okay, if 40% of the population has it, is there some evolutionary benefit? Because survival of the fittest was a thing. I don't think it is anymore, nearly as much, because we have IVF treatments, and there's nothing against that. It's just a point that I'm making, that the survival of the fittest is not really there anymore. We have very sick people having kids, and very sick people having kids are passing on genetic variations in mass to these children who are born into an environment that's more toxic than our parents and their grandparents and our great grandparents lived in. And so we're creating humans that are genetically inferior, epigenetically inferior. An environment that is massively inundated with, and it's terrifying. It's really terrifying. The autism spike is amazing. Back to MTHFR before I get on my tangents, which I'm very good at. So if someone has the MTHFR variation, first I do say, okay, there is some evolutionary benefit. And I will give a shout out to Rachel Krantz, who helped me write Dirty Genes. Because when I was talking with her in writing the book, she goes, she would be hearing me talking about MTHFR or CMT or all these things. She goes, I'm hearing you talk about these things, and there's got to be some benefit to these things. I was like, I quickly answered, maybe, and I just kept going. And then I stopped because she made me stop. She's a New Yorker. She goes, no, I'm serious. Let's pause here a moment. This is an important topic. She goes, what could the benefits be of MTHFR? And I was like, wow, okay. I like this. And I really struggled with it. I said, let me just call you back. I'll ponder it. And I've heard things, and I've actually read research on it, but it's been a while, that people who have MTHFR survive malaria better. And when I say people have MTHFR, I don't mean they have the gene, because we all have the gene or we're dead. You have the MTHFR genetic variations that reduce the functionality genetically, enzymatically, of the MTHFR enzyme, okay? So you have an MTHFR gene that codes for the MTHFR enzyme. If you have a genetic variation of 1298, it alters the code a little bit, which then alters the shape of the enzyme a little bit. And if you have another variation of 677, it alters the shape. It alters the code again of the gene, which then alters the shape of the enzyme it's produced even more. And you try to catch a baseball with two fingers like this, you're not going to catch it very well. And the function of the MTHFR enzyme in the area of the 677, at least, is to bind the cofactor of riboflavin. And riboflavin tries to bind and it falls off. So if you inundate the system, as Dr. Bruce Ames talks about, you have huge amounts of riboflavin. Eventually, it will bind, and the MTHFR enzyme will perform. So the cofactor binding affinity of riboflavin is reduced in individuals with MTHFR 677. 1298 is a bit funky and more, I think it's the end or the SAMe regulatory site. But regardless, this is a huge topic. We can spend hours just on the MTHFR enzyme, which is amazing. But to go back towards individuals who have gotten malaria, And if they have the NTGFR enzyme, why would that be? Why would somebody survive if they have the NTGFR variation compared to someone who don't? And you need to think mechanistically. You don't just think, oh, they have NTGFR SNP, they survive malaria. No, think. And remember when I think I talked about it earlier already in this discussion, maybe 10 minutes ago, where MTGFR's sole job is to make methylfolate. And then I said, hold on, it's also to conserve upstream folate. What does that mean? Okay, MTGFR is the last folate processing gene in the series of folate genes. It's the last one. And the last stop is MTGFR, and then it converts some form of folate into methylfolate. The upstream folates also have different jobs to do. And so they make your white blood cells, they make your DNA bases. Folinic acid is calcium folinate as a supplement, extremely important. So when I see prenatal vitamins just having methylfolate, I'm like, wow, you missed. So individuals who had malaria, they are busting through red blood cells like crazy. And so the upstream folate helps them produce more red blood cells, because the MTGFR enzyme is slowed down with these MTGFR genetic variations. They're not producing as much methylfolate anymore, which means it's conserving upstream folates for red blood cells, white blood cells, DNA bases. Nobody talks about this, including me, which is stupid. And they survive because they're able to reproduce these red blood cells so they can actually oxygenate and live. And also what happens is, if you think about sun exposure on your skin, there's a lot of fear around sunburn. And I have a neighbor who's a dermatologist. I'm smiling. I shouldn't be smiling. It's actually sad. But in the summer, it's unbelievable. The guy walks out in full gear as he's going to war. He has a sombrero. I shit you not. He's got a handkerchief, big sunglasses, zinc oxide in any skin that's on his ears, and overalls, gloves. And it's summer in 75, 80 degrees in Seattle, which we have very short summers for, and we're all laying in the sun. But he's a dermatologist. His job is removing skin cancer all day, every day. So I laugh, but it's actually very sad, because he's walking around with arthritis. And my kid's friend the other day, he's like, who's that? I said, oh, it's my neighbor. And he goes, God, why is he walking so slowly? I said, yeah, because he's so damn vitamin D deficient that his bones are falling apart. So back to the sunburn. So when you burn your skin, that is oxidative damage, and you need to regrow new skin. You don't do that with methylfolate. You do that with upstream folates. So if you get a sunburn, the folate that you aim towards is folinic acid and not methylfolate. And everybody thinks that the only folate that you should be taking is methylfolate, but it's not. So MTGFR's job, again, produce methylfolate, regulate upstream folates. That's a very important point. How do you support MTGFR? The first thing I always tell people to do when they're supporting any gene, and when you're supporting a gene, you're thereby supporting the enzyme, is to reduce the work it has to do. Don't make it work so damn hard. If you don't have to make it work so hard, it doesn't really matter that our MTGFR enzyme is reduced in function by about 70%. So if we give it 70% less work, we're at 100% capacity. Okay, so what do we have to do in order to make our MTGFR enzyme not work so damn hard? Don't be exposed to nitrous oxide, laughing gas from the dentist or surgical offices. Nitrous oxide, for me as a kid, laughing gas, I don't know. Have you ever had it?
No.
Oh my God. I felt so bad as a kid. I remember laying there on the dentist chair afterwards. They took the mask off. I was done with my dental procedure. And I just lay there and my head felt awful. I felt so stupid. I felt super dizzy. I felt pukey. I was not in a good mood. And it lasted for a long time. And I studied nitrous oxide exposure on the MTGFR individuals. And there's a plethora of research, actually, a lot of research on MTGFR and nitrous oxide. And there was so much so that actually I've given a number of talks to integrative holistic dentists in these conferences. And it was interesting when I was giving the presentation, I'd talk about all this data and nitrous oxide exposure. And I would look at the audience, 300 or so of them. And I said, who's the most at risk for nitrous oxide exposure in your office, do you think? And people would raise hand. My patients, kids who get it, people who have MTGFR. I said, yeah,
dentist. It's true.
All of you are the most at risk because that nitrous oxide is leaking through your patient's mask. You're taking it off. It's still on. You're putting it on. And you're cranking it before it's even on them, you're exposing yourself to nitrous oxide all day long. You are most at risk. Your hygienists are most at risk. And that's what they found in the research. And if you have an MTGFR genetic variation and you are exposed to nitrous oxide on a consistent basis or laughing gas or even an inconsistent basis, you're going to be struggling. And I wrote an article about this on MTGFR.net. And the comments. Go there and read the comments. They're unbelievable. Because what happens is nitrous oxide oxidizes B12. It damages it. And you need to have a duo of methylcobalamin and methylfolate in order to process the homocysteine. And what happens with nitrous oxide is it damages the methylcobalamin. You could have all the methylfolate in the world, but it doesn't have its partner of methylcobalamin. And the homocysteine levels just start skyrocketing.
What if you were, let's say somebody were to take more B12, you think that would get rid of the problem in terms of, I'm not saying anyone wants to get exposed to nitrous oxide, whether you have the MTHFR or not.
No, it's a good point. Yeah.
But the question is, if you take some methylfolate, maybe some folinic acid, some B12, do you counteract those risks?
Yes.
Not sure.
Yes.
You do.
Yes. Okay. And I think a big risk factor that you see in kids as well is a lot of them are anemic because they're growing so damn fast. They're low in folate because their white blood cells, red blood cells, DNA are replicating at high rates, especially if they have an infection or just grow in a growth spurt. And a lot of them are B12 deficient because A, they're being supplemented with crappy cyanocobalamin, even if they're getting a multivitamin. In America, a lot of parents are busy and they buy breakfast cereals and these kids are eating 80%, 90% processed foods, and they're not eating red meat because red meat is frowned upon here in the United States because it's killing the planet. And that's why I've been my recommendation is it's like some people say they have to have nitrous oxide. Nitrous oxide, what is that? Again, think mechanisms. Nitrous oxide is an anxiolytic. Its job is to reduce anxiety in moments of stress. Dentists are scary. Surgery is scary. And having your baby, delivering your baby is scary. They have now nitrous oxide in pregnancy wards, labor wards, because moms are stressed out from having a baby. And I don't blame them. That's a lot of pain. But now the baby is exposed to nitrous oxide. If you proactive measures of supplementing with methylfolate acid, and glutathione, both or all these combined, you are definitely going to significantly reduce the risks or even completely, I wouldn't say completely mitigate, because anytime you're slowing methylation process down, something is not going to be ideal. But the whole point of taking nitrous oxide is to feel less stressed out. That's also really important because that also inhibits your methylation. So just mitigate beforehand.
How much folinic acid versus methylfolate do you take? What's the dosing that you'll take?
Yeah, it depends on the situation. Let me give a story on this one to help folks. So years ago, I gave a presentation about MTGFR and folate because you need to talk about both. And I actually led with folate and then I got into MTGFR later. And folate metabolism is very interesting. If you look at folic acid and you look at methylfolate and you don't know anything about biochemistry, they look identical, exactly the same, except there's a little hash mark on the methylfolate versus the folic acid. And what's that little hash mark? That's where a methyl group sits. So the only difference between folic acid and methylfolate is a methyl group. The rest is identical. But I will tell you, to put a methyl group on folic acid is a bitch. It has to go through about 6 enzymatic steps. And the DHFR enzyme is super, super slow in humans. all the research done on DHFR in order to put folic acid in the food supply was done on mice. And mice have a very fast DHFR enzyme, so dihydrofolate reductase. Humans have a very slow dihydrofolate reductase. So we went to market by looking at mice studies. And folinic acid, to go back into the story, a doctor came up to me or emailed me. I can't remember how it went down, but she goes, "Ben, I have a patient who is on chemo, and I know I'm not supposed to give him folic acid, and I gave him methylfolate. So what's the problem?" Chemo, hair loss, white blood cells, red blood cells, platelets. The chemo is just wrecking all that. I was like, okay, what type of folate supports hair growth, white blood cells, and red blood cells and platelets? And then I said, folinic acid does all that. You were using methylfolate. She goes, "Oh." I said, "Methylfolate can become folinic acid. It can. It has to go through the MTR, MTRR pathway with methylcobalamin and becomes tetrahydrofolate. After methylfolate donates its methyl group to cobalamin and homocysteine, then it's back as tetrahydrofolate, methyl tetrahydrofolate, if you're going to be specific. Then it donates its methyl group to the homocysteine and cobalamin thing through the MTR-MTRR enzyme. Then it becomes tetrahydrofolate. Then through tetrahydrofolate, it goes through a couple enzymatic steps, one through the MTHFD1 enzyme to become folinic acid. And the MTHFDS enzyme is there too, I believe. And so now that's possible. But the problem is that MTR-MTRR intersection is jammed with stuff that prevents the passage of methyl tetrahydrofolate and methylcobalamin, especially during chemo. Why? Because the MTR-MTRR junction is strongly inhibited by oxidative stress. And what is chemo? Chemo is massive amounts of oxidative stress. That's what it is. And you can't be giving heaps of glutathione during someone on chemo because it negates the purpose of giving chemo. So you can't be giving a bunch of glutathione during chemo. You can do it after, but not during. And talk with professionals about when is very important. So I said, you need to give this individual folinic acid because then it can get through and make the red blood cells and white blood cells and platelets. And she goes, "How much?" I said, "I would start with a milligram. And the most folinic acid is over the counter at 800 micrograms. So just start with that." And you don't want them to get too anxious and you don't want to be producing too many DNA because that's food for the cancer as well to replicate. And so it's a balance. So mechanistically, you look at these things and you think, okay, this is how it should be. But in reality, sometimes it doesn't always go that way. So dosage of folinic acid is very touch and go because as you can't look at just MTHFD1 and MTHFR and MTR, you have to look at CMT and MAO-A and biopterin and all these other things. And some people are very sensitive to a slight increase of neurotransmitters or a slight increase of histamine. So it's very patient-centric. And I don't mean that to be a cop-out answer, not to be a very respectful answer for all of us are 99.9% genetically identical, but that 0.1% variation is extremely valuable and you need to honor that. And so I would recommend, I like using lozenges of folates because you can put the entire lozenge in your mouth if you want, or you can cut it in half or quarters and let it dissolve. And I kid you not, as you're letting the folinic acid dissolve or the methylfolate dissolve, pay attention to how your head is feeling currently, how your mood is feeling currently, how the blood flow in your hand is feeling currently. Couple, like a minute in, you could even bite it once to expose more surface area of the lozenge. I do recommend that. Bite it once, expose more surface area, it dissolves a bit faster. And you feel your head clearing, okay? I'm feeling the center of my head clear. It's going over the tops of my ears. Okay, good. Okay, now my eyes are brighter. My mood is better. Now I'm feeling my head get a little bit of a buzz. Oh, now I'm getting anxious. Spit it out. You're done. It's that fast. That's that fast for me. How is it for you?
First of all, you made me a seeking health folinic acid to my car as we're talking. I'm like, all right, yeah. What's going on here? I just like to, but this gets into another question that I'm very curious of your take. So I really like your approach of data-driven, right? You're data-driven, you're precise. You don't want to take things that are not going to do anything or that might make you worse. I take a similar approach. I'm a little more gung-ho for myself. I don't recommend it for other people.
Yeah, for sure.
We have different risk tolerances. We have different goals. And I know my body. I know I'm okay with something going wrong and then I have to fix it.
Yeah, that's personally. Okay. Yeah, the 3 Fs, I call it. Friends, fools, and family. Yeah.
Exactly. I treat myself differently. I think the way you're talking is more like it makes more sense for regular people. They want to be careful before they do something. They want to try to be as sure as possible that this really makes something really makes sense for them. Titrate the dosage carefully. For me, for example, here's my approach. I'm curious how you relate to that. So I'm a little bit of an extreme personality. I like to take things to the edge and see how far I can take things. And what I'll do is I'll identify biomarkers, number one. I'll look at my genetics. They give me clues about what I need to do. But then I look at the biomarkers that I want to test that are related to these things, right? And so when we're talking about MTHFR and methylfolate, we're going to be talking about homocysteine as one of the main markers. If we're talking about B12, we're going to be talking about methylmalonic acid and serum B12. And also we're going to be talking about serum folate, right? I think those are some of the important lab tests that we want to be looking at. And then I'm also going to look at how do I feel from this? Do I notice any improvement? Do I notice any negatives? And I can give you my experience. What I personally, I don't take folinic acid, but now I'm going to take it. I guess I never really thought about why I need folinic acid on its own. I just assume that if I take enough methylfolate, the body will create what it needs to folinic acid, however much folinic acid I need. Maybe I'm wrong about that.
For you, it might.
Okay. I don't know, right? But then that's why I want to try the folinic acid. Again, I don't recommend everybody just try everything. You want to try to be as precise as possible. For me, I just try everything no matter what. If there's a new supplement on the market, I'm trying it. So that's just my personal approach. But what I'm looking at is those lab markers, how I feel. I personally take 2 milligrams of methylfolate a day, right? And I don't notice any negatives from it. And part of the reason I do that is because I'm an undermethylator. My genetics, we look at over 30 SNPs for methylation as a whole, including MTHFR and other ones. I come up as low. And I find that I'm okay as long as I don't exercise a lot. When I exercise a lot, my homocysteine goes through the roof.
Yep.
And because exercise uses a lot of methylation, so it's placing that stress. And then with the genetic predisposition, all of a sudden, my homocysteine goes up. So I need to take a lot of methyl supplements. So I only, with the amount that I'm exercising now, my goal is to get, and I got it there. It's only there now, recently. My goal is to get it to 9 homocysteine. And in order to do that, I needed to basically go gung-ho on a lot of methylation supplements like TMG. I take 4 grams a day. I take the methylcobalamin. I take 7 grams a day of MSM, which has a methyl group. I take the methylfolate, B6, in the form of P5P. With all that, I finally get to homocysteine of 9, right? And by the way, and I also feel fine, right? I don't have any headaches or anxiety or anything like that. So I'm curious about if somebody feels fine, would you be like, look, 2 milligrams of methylfolate is problematic? Or like, how would you go about that?
No, absolutely not. Your approach, very sound. It makes sense. And everyone's approach can be slightly different. If it works for you, do it. If it's not working for you, change it up. One of my weaknesses, and I would admit it as a weakness, I don't like needles. I don't like lab tests. I like lab tests, but I don't like needles. And I don't check biomarkers enough. And I think I don't check biomarkers because I'm so in tune with how I feel. But that said, that could be problematic because I could be missing something. And I have missed something. And that was, when I do go in and actually get stuck with a needle and get things checked, I will find things that I was like, oh, that's surprising. I'm high estrogen. That's weird. Or my white blood cell count is finally normal. My entire life, my white blood cells were low. My entire life, always L.
What was the number? Do you remember?
It was just under. Okay. Yeah, I don't.
By the way, I was the same way, and then it got normalized around 2016, 2015.
Right. Yeah.
And you know what it was from? For me, it was the food sensitivities. The food sensitivities. When you have like inflammation, let's say in your gut,
that makes sense.
Then your body is using white blood cells,
right?
So it's taking it away from circulation, and then it's attacking the gut or wherever you have that inflammation, if you have it in different places, and it lowers just the white blood cell. It's not a huge amount, but like it was just consistently 4.0. And the range is, the minimum is 4.0. And then at a certain point, it just, now my new range is 5 to 6.5, which I think is healthier for immunity. Yeah.
That's awesome. Yeah, that makes total sense. I never thought of it that way. But yeah, you're right. It normalized for me when I went gluten-free and dairy-free.
There you go.
Yeah. And
it's not a huge change, meaning like it's probably 5 now or something like that, right?
Yeah, right, yeah.
That's pretty common. I see it.
Yeah. Doctors should pay attention to that. And folks, you should pay attention to that too. That's a big one. That's a big thing. Because persistently low white blood cell counts, that's a problem. Your immune system is extremely important. That's your sentinels for fighting cancer cells that we all have every single day. I have a buddy of mine who's an influencer, super well-known, super healthy. His homocysteine is around a 10. And the guy is walking health for the most part. Diet is pristine. Lifestyle, pristine. And he's dealing with a higher homocysteine. And so he's been trying the methylfolate. He's been trying the folinic acid. And it makes him super agitated and irritable. And he exercises a lot. And that is one thing I'm going to reach out to him today and say, hey, exercise increases your homocysteine. And I said, did you do your homocysteine fasted? Yes. Did you do it in the morning? Yes. Okay. Are you eating a lot of protein at night? Is your biggest meal done at night? Yes. Make that change. There's something called methionine loading. What's that?
That's a good one. I like that.
Yeah. So if you look up methionine loading in PubMed or Google, methionine loading is where they will load up a patient with methionine, i.e. protein, but they will specifically use amino acid methionine to try to push and the methylation cycle to see how fast they can convert that methionine into homocysteine and back to methionine again. And so if some people are super sensitive to this, if they methionine load with say a gram of methionine and their homocysteine is at 15, then we have a blockage somewhere. We have a slowdown somewhere. If you methionine load with 5 grams and your homocysteine is at 10, that's pretty good. So if he's loading up with protein at night and he only has, maybe his appointment's 12 hours later, maybe his methionine system is really low and sluggish. So then what do you do? So you want to optimize that. And glutathione is something that you should be doing. One thing people don't understand, and I looked at this when I drew my diagrams a long time ago, and I'm always refining them with my team as well. But if you look at the methylation cycle, you've got your CBS down here, which is where your homocysteine resides, and it goes down to glutathione. And then you have your homocysteine, which goes over to the 9 o'clock mark. That's where your MTRR system resides, which is fed by your methylfolate over here. So you have two circles. And in the middle of the circle is where the MTRR intersects the methylfolate and the methylcobalamin, and you have the homocysteine down here. So that MTR and MTRR intersection is redox sensitive. They are actually sentinels for oxidative stress. If there is a higher presence of oxidative stress, the MTR complex stops and you're like, that sucks. Well, hold on. Well, that's what I thought when I read the research. And then it was maybe a month later, I'm studying CBS. And CBS is also redox sensitive. In high oxidative stress states, CBS is stimulated. Well, okay, what does that mean? High redox, high states of oxidative stress, the CBS enzyme is told to perform faster. The MTHFR complex is told to work slower. And when I looked at that, I was like, that's genius. Why? Because if you have high levels of oxidative stress, that means you're low in glutathione. So the body will take that homocysteine, promote the function of the CBS enzyme, and pull that homocysteine down into production of glutathione. And the glutathione levels will increase. The oxidative stress will go down. The MTHFR complex will say, oh, the oxidative stress is lower. We're going to turn on. The CBS enzyme will say, oh, the redox situation is better. We're going to slow down. Homocysteine now is conserved for methylation instead of being pulled down into glutathione. And that is something that I need to be talking to him about, because glutathione will drive up your homocysteine if it's low. But then you will also say, if he's low glutathione, couldn't he have low homocysteine? Yes, that's also true. And low homocysteine is nowhere to be found. Have you ever seen, Joe, a low homocysteine range on a lab?
I've never found it, no.
No, doesn't exist. Homocysteine isn't bad. It's a necessity. Histamine isn't bad. Everybody thinks histamine is bad. And the lower that you have, the lower histamine level, the better it is. The lower the homocysteine, the better it is. No, there's a sweet spot for probably almost everything, except for
I've actually had a situation where I had low histamine for a while.
Oh, yeah.
And I found that for me, all I needed to do was take histidine and it fixed it.
Exactly.
And,
yep.
Yeah. And the symptoms were just like maybe like a little bit more tired and then also less stomach acidity because histamine is. And I was trying to, my goal was, how do I get more stomach acidity? Because I always felt like my stomach needs like a little more acidity. I was like taking apple cider vinegar, you know, doing the Band-Aids, HCL, which is fine as Band-Aids, but I'm like you, I want to get to the core problem. What? And so I was looking at different things and I figured out different things. And then the last thing that I figured out and it just solved it was, wait a second. I noticed that in my amino acid panel, my histidine levels were consistently low. A serum amino acid test. And I'm like, okay, let me take histidine. And then I took histidine and I took it at 9 p.m. by mistake. And I didn't go to sleep until 9 a.m.
Yeah. Right.
I was like, okay, this makes sense. Histidine is going to convert histamine and it's going to keep me awake the whole night.
Yep.
And then, and then after that, my stomach acidity, like I've never had a problem. And the wakefulness, that was great. And my amino acids, they normalized just when I started taking some more histidine.
Yeah. How much?
So I first took 1.5 grams. And then I take 3 grams a day. By the way, if you want to see my histidine levels here on the screen, you can check it out. Could you see that? So you see that I took it twice here. And the reason I took it twice is I wanted to verify that it's low then and it's not a fluke. And I took it. You could see it's around 2 weeks apart. And both times it was low.
On this, did you take histidine in isolation or did you take it with a bunch of other amino acids?
No, in isolation.
Okay.
I just took histidine. So then I said, once I tested it twice, I said, okay, I'm low on histidine. Let's see what happens when I take histidine. Lo and behold, my histidine levels normalize. And actually, it fluctuates. So you see it went a little lower. That's because my body was fighting an infection and your body's going to use more histamine when you're fighting an infection. Mm-hmm. I didn't really have any significant symptoms, but I noticed a lot of my amino acids went lower. And then you see it went back to normal once my body just fought it off. But I'll do testing when my body's fighting an infection. And that actually helps me figure out what are the ingredients I need to make my immune system more robust. And so now my immune system is like a game changer. It's 10 times stronger than it's ever been through the testing, actually. And this is just one example of what I figured out. But you could see just with the histidine, me trying out different dosing now and under different circumstances, that like February 6th, just 4 days later, went down because of the infection. But here I'm taking 3 grams. So you see when I'm taking 1.5, it went up to 85. And then when I'm taking 3 grams, it went up to 102, whereas it was 38 just as the baseline. This is where I really like testing. And then not only just testing, but also doing an experiment after the fact and making sure that this is actually changing the lab marker and something is improving in my body. And the reason one of the reasons I tested this, there's a lot of reasons, but there's studies that show serum histidine is related to longevity. And I was like, we don't know 100% that it's causal, but why do I want to be low? Let me see what happens when I'm on the higher end and I just feel better on the higher end. So that's an example of, like you said, you don't want to be low on histamine. And I don't have any histamine issues either, by the way. So that's an interesting thing with histidine supplementation. They haven't found that when you increase histamine through the histidine, that there's any symptoms of high histamine. And just by the way, one of the interesting things you'll notice is you see over here. Okay, so because I take B6, my serum B6 is typically high, right? And so you see here it's 70. And when I took the histidine, it went down quite dramatically. And the reason is because you use B6 in order to convert histidine into histamine. Yep. And then histamine into whatever the metabolite is after that. But essentially, I've titrated my B6 dosage because when you take more histidine, then you also need more B6.
Right.
So this is where it gets complex sometimes. And that's why I'm saying you don't want to willy-nilly just start taking random stuff. But I do a lot of this stuff for me, it's a sport. Cool. Just the last thing here, I just wanted to show you my homocysteine because we were talking about it. That there were some spikes. And one of the spikes also fighting an infection. I like to do tests when I'm fighting an infection. And some of them, sometimes it was just random. I actually didn't know I had an infection here until the next day. But you could see that it was higher. And then over time, I'm just doing additional things to get it under that 9, essentially. And finally, I finally got it to 8.8 here. Mm. And that's how I know it's okay. That's why I'm like, I'm trying to get a little more help from the methyl B12 and the methyl folate. And the thing is that I don't want to go too high on the B12 because if you look at my B12, it's starting to get too high here, right? Like in the blood.
They say it's too high. You have to ask yourself, where are they getting these ranges from?
I looked up the all-cause mortality. There's a little problem with B12. There's no optimal range, really. And the reason, you could only see it on the lower end because you could see if people are low, then they might be at higher risk for certain things. The problem is at the higher end, people have higher B12 when they have a lot of different conditions. And so actually it's a risk if you have high B12 and you're not taking B12.
That's right.
The question then becomes, what if you are taking B12 like me and then you have high B12? I'm curious what you think of that.
I don't know. I haven't looked into the negative effects of excessive B12 in the system. The only thing I can think of is if you have anything persistently high for a long period of time, your body will compensate and your B12 transport proteins might be going down. Your B12 receptor sensitivity might go down. Think of diabetes and blood sugar, right? So if you're constantly having B12 elevated, the body is it's going to compromise somewhere. So you can actually be looking at a vitamin B binding capacity. So I'd order a B12 binding capacity test.
Do you want to hear about the one health hack that is sure to change your life? Okay, here it is. Subscribing to this podcast. 67% of listeners aren't following the show. So please don't forget to show your support by hitting the follow button now. You'll not only be supporting the show, but also investing in yourself and your health journey, all while helping to keep us ad-free. I actually have a theory about methylfolate and some of the side effects. And I don't know, I'm actually very curious about what you think, because I could be wrong. It's just a theory. And why I also don't experience side effects. And because I actually did experience a little bit of side effects at a certain point. I don't think from methylfolate, but from a lot of methyl supplements. My theory, and again, I'm curious what you think. When you take methylfolate, what happens is that you accelerate the conversion of tryptophan to serotonin. And so I think that some people might feel very good when they have that acceleration because you have that initial boost. The problem is that a lot of people are low on tryptophan. And you could see in the amino acids, like I actually was on the low, I was low on my serum tryptophan. Even when I'm taking a lot of tryptophan, I was still on the lower end. But before I was certainly low. And I find a lot of people are low on serotonin in general. And so when you take methylfolate, you accelerate that conversion. And so I think one way to maybe reduce the side effects is to increase the raw material of tryptophan. That's one way. I think the niacin could have helped, potentially. There's probably other mechanisms. Because when you're deficient on niacin, you basically take up all the tryptophan. Right. That's one of the easiest ways to become deficient in tryptophan because it's a 60-to-1 ratio, right? It's like you need 60 milligrams of niacin, of tryptophan, to create 1 milligram of niacin. And you need a lot more niacin to be... So I was always a heavy user of, a heavy utilizer of niacin. I was always niacin deficient in my life until the past 2 years when I actually, through blood testing, by the way, I figured it out. Not only just one test, serum niacin, also other tests. You could check serum phosphorus. There's a bunch of tests. But so I realized my whole life I was deficient in niacin. That actually fixed a lot of food sensitivities. And I also take tryptophan as well. But when you're deficient on niacin, which this person might have been, they took methylfolate, they sucked up, they started transferring more tryptophan to serotonin. Eventually they ran out. And with serotonin, you have these stores and then you can run out. And then when you run out, you feel like you're going mad. It's a mood instability. And I've had that in the past, so I know what that feels like. I haven't had it ever since taking niacin and tryptophan. So I'm curious what you think of that. If there's maybe, that's the only one I can think of. I'm sure there's other ways to think about that.
That's a big one because, as you said, tryptophan is bidirectional. So during, it's tridirectional because tryptophan will be going down the kynurenine pathway to support immunity and immune modulation. And it will go down to make niacin, and then it'll go another way to make your serotonin.
And then another way to make indoles, which create tolerance in the gut, which is why one of the reasons I take it as well.
Yeah, that one I'm familiar with. Yeah, so like indole 3-carbinol?
That's a similar compound. I'm not sure. I don't know if it makes that one, but there's one called IP3 or I3P. Basically,
right.
There's indole. I forgot the exact names for all of them. There's a bunch of indoles. It could be indole. I don't know if indole 3-carbinol is one of them.
That one's
but they have the same path. They have the same, they activate the same thing. They're both aryl hydrocarbon receptor activators, which create tolerance in the gut, actually, which is one of the reasons I started taking tryptophan, and it worked. It cured a lot of my food sensitivities, if not all of them.
I offered tryptophan years ago at Seeking Health, and along with about 150 other products. We've cut 150 SKUs over the years.
Seriously? Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. I probably should have just kept them all available, but for the exception of something like the methyl-free ones, if they weren't big performers, I just chop them. And tryptophan, I knew how important tryptophan was, but when you have 100 plus, 200 plus SKUs, it's hard to educate on 200 plus SKUs.
100%.
So I got overwhelmed and I was like, I need to really refine the product line so I can really dive deeper in providing tools for people with more education, because tryptophan is a phenomenal amino acid and it's overlooked. And you're reminding me of its importance. And so, but back to tryptophan or the niacin, I wrote an article called Methylfolate Side Effects. And it's the most read article on MTGFR.net to this day, because so many people test for MTGFR. They're told to take methylfolate. They're told to take a high amount of methylfolate. They don't look at anything else and they feel terrible. A lot of them do. Some of them feel great. That's awesome. But I have mechanisms in there. And so one of them has to do with niacin is a methyl consumer as well. So high dose niacin is actually a problem in that it can cause fatty liver and cause liver damage. And why is that? is because it consumes methyl groups. 50 milligrams, though, is not really going to consume that many methyl groups, but it might consume enough in to offset whatever many micrograms of methylfolate that they took. And like you also said, the back pressure of tryptophan going to niacin, you've slowed that. So that
I wonder with the methylation thing, like, and I don't know the answer to this. I'm curious what you think. People say over-methylators. If they're over-methylating, we would probably see a low homocysteine. And I barely see anybody with low homocysteine. I've never seen it personally. I've heard about it. Never I've seen the test in front of me. Yeah. But I've heard some people say, yeah, I've had homocysteine of 4 or 5, whatever. Right. Heard it. But I've never actually seen it with my own eyes. I'm assuming it occurs. It happens. You've seen it. Okay, great.
I've seen it, yeah.
It's rare, though.
It's rare. And it's not good. And typically, I have an article on low homocysteine as well. I think at drbenlynch.com, but some mechanisms there. Basically, it's low protein, not absorbing protein, not eating protein, or it's high oxidative stress combined with low glutathione. Those are the main ones that I've come up with. And so typically my recommendation is eat more protein and supplement with glutathione and make sure when you eat the more protein, you're actually absorbing it and digesting it, or digesting it and absorbing it.
And you could see your total serum protein. And if you want to even be fancier, you could also do a serum amino acids. But even just a regular blood test, you look at total serum protein, you'll see how many how much protein is in your blood.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, you're making me want to do more blood testing.
I have that effect on people. My question is, you know, how many people, how big of this over-methylation, is this over-methylation hyped up? I really, I'm not sure. I don't know how to make sense of it because when I look at the homocysteine, it's almost never low. Where's this over-methylation coming from? And is it true? Do you think it's true?
No. The whole concept of over and under-methylation is nonsense. It's total and utter nonsense. There might be areas. One thing you have to keep in mind is you have enzymes and biochemical pathways going on in multiple areas of your body all day, all night. And you can have high homocysteine levels in your muscles, and you could have lower or healthier homocysteine levels in your heart. And then you're taking a blood test and you're getting an average of all of it. So keep in mind that you have enzymes, the CBS enzyme and other enzymes are tissues. They are in multiple tissues, multiple organs. And when you insult a specific organ, muscles or cardiovascular system when you're exercising, respiratory system when you're exercising, those will probably be producing more homocysteine than, say, skin cells or what have you. So I want to put that out there, that you need to think about which organs are producing the compound, because a blood test is an average of all of those that are actually able to get into the bloodstream itself. So that's an important point. And so with over and under methylation, you could have methylation occurring at a high rate in your skin if you have eczema, because for skin repair. You could have methylation at a very low rate in your heart and in other areas. And so by stating I'm an under methylator, it's like, okay, where, which part, what time of day, and why do you say that specifically? And what they'll, and to prove my point, a common lab test done or a common symptom, I always get this wrong, so hopefully I don't screw it up. An over-methylator will have low histamine.
Histamine.
An under-methylator will have high histamine. Okay, let's look at the histamine pathway. And I'm talking about they'll have high histamine symptoms and they'll have low histamine symptoms. And if you look at the histamine pathway, the first step to metabolize histamine is through the HNMT enzyme, the methyltransferase enzyme, to process histamine to methylhistamine using SAMe. Then if you're an over-methylator, you will have low histamine levels. And methylhistamine, if it accumulates, will put back pressure on the HNMT enzyme through feedback inhibition, and it will actually increase your histamine levels. I'm confused, all right? N-methylhistamine isn't the last stop for histamine metabolism. There's two other enzymes that are at play, monoamine oxidase, MAO-A and MAO-B, and then you also have, it's tissue specific, and then you have the ALDH enzymes, the aldehyde dehydrogenase enzymes. You need both of those MAO-A and ALDH enzymes working in order to process that methylhistamine. And so by saying that you're an over-methylator and you have, no, you're an under-methylator and you have high histamine levels is nonsense, because a lot of people will take SAMe or they'll take methylfolate or methylcobalamin or whatever, TMG, and try to knock down their histamine levels. They might have some success. However, they also could be deficient in riboflavin, thiamine, vitamin C, zinc, and these other cofactors, and they'll still feel like they're struggling with high histamine symptoms, and a lot of people do, which is exactly why I had SAMe for a long time. I still do at Seeking Health by itself. Some people will take SAMe and they will feel better, and other people will take SAMe and they feel no change. In fact, they might feel worse. And so that's where I designed histamine nutrients. The nutrients, like, why would I say histamine nutrients? It nourishes the histamine pathway. You're providing nutrition for the histamine pathway, and it opens up the entire histamine pathway. And so then you're actually able to metabolize histamine completely and get it out of the system. And that stuff works within 20 minutes. Within 20 minutes, your symptoms of higher histamine levels are already reducing. And it's pretty ridiculous.
And what are those supplements in that formula?
Yeah, it's SAMe, it's DAO enzyme, B6, copper, zinc, B1, alpha-ketoglutarate, PQQ, because you have ammonia buildup, or you have ammonia toxicity and hydrogen peroxide levels being produced, which also slows methylation, which slows your ability to break down histamine. So those are also in there. I feel like I'm forgetting a couple others, but that's it.
That's fine.
Yeah. So
I wanted to ask you something about riboflavin, actually, because I was looking into...
Oh, that's in there too. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I was looking into riboflavin supplements and Seeking Health came up. And one of the things that's interesting, I mean, you have both riboflavin and riboflavin 5-phosphate, and both forms are found in food. When I'm trying to figure out what form I want to take, I don't know the answer to that. So I just, you know, I don't know. I guess I'm mixing them both. Well, what do you think is, how does somebody know what kind of riboflavin to take?
It's a very good question, because if you talked with people about pyridoxine hydrochloride or pyridoxine 5-phosphate or riboflavin hydrochloride or riboflavin 5-phosphate, there's a camp of people, and they may be right, that says it's stupid to supplement with the 5-phosphate versions because your body has to dephosphorylate anyway in order to absorb, and then the body has to rephosphorylate. And I was like, okay. And maybe it's not to absorb, but to get it into the cell. And so I don't know how I feel about that. And I think they might be right.
But there's a difference between the two. Let's say the B6, right? The pyridoxal 5-phosphate. At least that's what's found in food. You don't get the pyridoxine hydrochloride in food.
Yeah.
Whereas the riboflavin, you get both of them in food. So
okay. It's
hard to, for me, it's, I could see some kind of ancestral health type argument, like with the B6. I don't know what the right answer is, but I could see some argument there, right? I don't know what the right answer is, but with the riboflavin, I'm very curious. Is it more like, same with the folic acid, you get a combination of methylfolate and folinic acid in food.
Right.
Right. So probably better to take both of them, like you said, right? Get some folinic acid as well.
I like taking both. And I will, I did an Instagram post the other day, because somebody asked me, when is the right time to take folic acid? And I immediately answered, never. And then I stepped back and then I stepped back and then I said, you know what? The only time to take folic acid is if you live in a food desert. But if you live in a food desert, you're probably already getting massive amounts of folic acid from the enriched foods that you're consuming. So even then, you probably wouldn't need to supplement with folic acid. It's a good question. Riboflavin is an underappreciated vitamin. Thiamine is underappreciated. I think most B vitamins are underappreciated.
I'd agree.
Yeah. And I do know as a supplement company, riboflavin 5-phosphate is extremely expensive compared to riboflavin HCL and the P5P as well compared to pyridoxine HCL. But I don't think I even use pyridoxine HCL in anything. I think I only use the 5-phosphate form. The riboflavin I will blend. And from talking with folks, the riboflavin 5-phosphate is way more potent than the HCL version. It's more potent taste-wise, and it's more potent biochemically. But I couldn't tell you why because I haven't really looked into it.
What do you think about, so when I look at all the B vitamins, I agree with you. I've noticed very good effects from all the B vitamins with the exception of B5. I just haven't noticed anything from it. I'm curious what you think.
B5 I love, but B5 you have to have I'm a higher doser of B5 than most people. People will look at my supplements and like, oh, you have 125 milligrams of B5 and yeah, you have 500 milligrams of B5 and they're, yeah. Actually, we're coming out with a skin supplement where I think I have 500 milligrams of B5 in there. It has to do with, I believe, sebum production. And so it's been a while since I formulated. It takes time to get to market. But I like it, but you need to be a higher doser, 500 milligrams minimum. I've had people take multiple grams of B5 and they say fat just sheds off of them when they take 2 or 3 grams of B5 a day. But then they need to be supplementing with biotin because too much B5 will reduce biotin availability for some reason.
Have you noticed any benefits for yourself from B5?
Yeah, I'm way more tolerant to stressors is my biggest one.
Oh, interesting. Wow.
Yeah, there was a lady who came to my house probably 20 years ago now, and she was really tired all the time, and she was cold all the time. She had difficulty waking up all the time, and I gave her a bottle of pantothenic acid. And I don't know why I gave her that at the time. I have so many things to think about, but maybe that's all I had. And I said, B5 is very good for energy. And there's moments too where I'll study something and I'll research something and I'll be on that bandwagon for a while. And B5, I think I was researching heavily. And so I gave her the B5 and yeah, she shot me a text and she goes, oh my God, thank you. I feel so much better.
Wow.
It has to do with a lot with carbohydrate metabolism and cortisol and adrenals and acetylcholine. So yeah, I have that in my optimal focus formulation as well.
And what do you think of the difference between calcium 5-pantothenate and pantothene?
Pantothene, I believe, is more cholesterol based mechanisms. The pantothenic acid is more the energy, adrenals, cofactor types support for acetylcholine and energy pathways, Krebs cycle. So that's my understanding. I see when I read pantothene research, I'm seeing cholesterol stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I see as well. But I was curious if it also has other benefits besides.
Oh, I would probably say yeah, but I don't know. I haven't looked into it.
Right.
Yeah.
I only see the research talk about cholesterol, but yeah. How many supplements do you take a day personally?
Well, I wake up in the morning. I take half of a glutathione lozenge, basically half to one, depending. So today I took a full lozenge, and that is using the S-acetyl glutathione, and it's only 25 milligrams. And you're like, 25 milligrams, that's nothing. When you have the right form of glutathione that has very low oxidation and the right deliverability and in enhanced absorption, that stuff hits. I originally tested 50 milligrams per lozenge and I got literally dizzy and nauseated and felt weird when I took half the lozenge at that time. I reduced it to 25. I felt way better. And my son, who was 13 at the time when I was testing, 15 now, takes that long, go to market. He felt the same as I did. So 25 milligrams of S-acetylglutathione. I take a serving of optimal electrolyte, which I have not had yet today. And that has mostly potassium. So it has 500 milligrams of potassium bicarbonate. I like the bicarbonate for the alkalinity.
Yeah.
I usually do it away from food. And then we have real salt in there, 150 milligrams of real salt. But that is, when I say real salt, I say 150 milligrams of sodium. But sodium is sodium chloride, NaCl. So it's actually not 150 milligrams of salt. It's, you know, NaCl or sodium is about 38%, or sodium chloride is 38% sodium. So then you're looking at another 60-some percent. So you're consuming about...
But it's still not a lot in terms of sodium instead of salt.
It's not, no. But I have that lower amount of sodium in there because so many people are high sodium, unless they're exercising or sweating or what have you. Then I tell people to take more sodium or add more salt to it. And then we have ATP in there. And that's the, I think it's the only electrolyte on the market that uses ATP. We used to have D-ribose in it, but now we use ATP. And the reason ATP is in there is because 40% of the body's energy at rest is used to pump magnesium and potassium into the cell. And a lot of people are struggling with mitochondrial dysfunction. And so by them just drinking potassium and magnesium, we have magnesium in there as well, 125 milligrams of malate, 150 cause loose stools. So I knocked it down to 125. And so the ATP will help push the mag and the potassium inside the cell. Hydration is not drinking water. Hydration is getting water inside your cells. That's hydration. And so a lot of people look at hydration as me just drinking this bottle of water. And if you're 1% dehydrated, your brain function goes down significantly.
100%.
And I feel like I'm dehydrated a bit right now. And plus, we've been talking about this type of information for quite some time, which is really demanding on the brain. And if you're not fueling that with ATP, because it's energy, it's, you're burning a lot of ATP for cognitive function. And so I also took, I'm testing our energy nutrients. I also take that sometimes in the morning. So when you wake up in the morning, you're in a fasted state. And some people have difficulty converting their stored glycogen, or they don't burn fuel very well. They don't convert glycogen back to glucose. There's a myriad of things at play, but they could be low cortisol, all sorts of things. And so by taking the energy nutrients lozenge, which is a combination of NADH and CoQ10, which is the first complex of your mitochondria, and I believe the third is where CoQ10 works, but I can't remember. But anyway, the NADH is complex one, CoQ10 helps shuttle the hydrogens. And so you take that NADH CoQ10, you just turn your brain on instantly. And you do the optimal electrolyte, your brain is on instantly because you got the ATP in there as well. Then you got the hydration and then the glutathione to clean things up, because you can support energy really well, but if you don't have sufficient glutathione on board, you're not doing great things. So that's how I start my day. And then I've been toying with testosterone. I've got a testosterone supplement that I'm finally going into production. I've been testing it for about 2 to 3 years, and you're going to say, how are your labs? And I'm going to say, I don't know, but I will tell you that my lean body mass has increased. My libido has increased. The TMI for some people, but this is a thing. When you're sleeping as a man, the parasympathetic state is really important. And testosterone is associated with a parasympathetic state. And for healthy sleep, testosterone levels have to be there. And so having a morning wood is a sign that your testosterone levels are healthy. And so I hadn't been experiencing that for a number of years, and it's back. I'm like, all right, that's great. So I use lifestyle factors instead of lab markers, but I actually have a testosterone test downstairs. I need to go do the damn thing because, yeah, I need to do it. So I've been taking testosterone every day, and then it's a combination of herbs and other cofactors. And then I take what's called Optimal Man, which is a multivitamin for men. And it also has testosterone support in there. So the testosterone nutrients and the Optimal Man is a combination supplement, because not all man needs testosterone supplementation.
How many pills would you say you take in a day?
I'm starting to slow down now because the morning is my biggest hit. Then I've got some couple pills here. So brain nutrients, I would say I would probably take 10 to 12 pills a day.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's a fair amount. It's a good amount.
Yeah. And it's taken throughout the day. And so brain nutrients is a lozenge. I love lozenges. And that hits really fast. Optimal focus I'll take if I'm working for a long period of time, or dopamine nutrients, I'm playing with those.
Does S-acetylglutathione make a difference if you're taking in a lozenge or orally, just swallowing it?
We do offer both. We actually have it in three deliverables now. We use S-acetylglutathione only. We've completely eliminated reduced glutathione. It's gone. It's not garbage, but it's not very good. S-acetylglutathione is a very stable form of glutathione, so you're not getting oxidized glutathione. And so we have it in capsule form, we have it in lozenge form, and we have it in liposomal form.
I've done a mega dose with that, a gram.
Oh my God. What happened?
Yeah, nothing.
Are you serious?
My homocysteine went down a little bit.
Wow, you're crazy. See, I can understand why you need to test so much. Yeah.
Yeah, because I'm doing crazy shit. I got to see what the hell's going on in my blood. I'm like, if I'm messing up if I'm doing crazy stuff, like I do crazy stuff. I don't recommend other people do it. It's a sport for me, right?
Yeah. No, I
know
it.
It's crazy. I'm living on the edge, but I also feel like I know how to fix things when they're broken. Right. So if you don't, then don't screw around, right? Yeah. And I just did an experiment now that got me screwed up a little bit. But I know exactly, like I was able to figure out what happened, why it happened. Right. You know, I was taking too much proline. And it turns out the proline shunts right into glutamate. And I made the same mistake with too much AKG. I was taking 15 grams of AKG a day.
Oh my God.
Yeah, exactly. Oh my God. And AKG turns into glutamate. So I started to get anxiety from the glutamate.
Mm-hmm.
And then I slowed down there. I obviously corrected that. And now I take a normal amount, still a lot, 5 grams a day. But then I saw on my blood test, sometimes I'll do an experiment, it goes wrong. There's no information what happens when your levels of proline are slightly on the lower end. They're not low, but like slightly on the lower end in a blood test consistently. But I think that as I up it, I don't think my proline wasn't going up. So I just started, let me take even more. But in the end, it just got converted to glutamate. I noticed, okay, I've got way too much glutamate now. And I'm taking like very high doses of B6 and N-acetylcysteine, taking 3,600 milligrams a day to knock my glutamate down, which is working. So it's absolutely working, but it's a little bit of a madman situation where I'm thinking, and I want to make sure. The problem is because I make 30 days worth of stuff. And so I loaded all my stuff with proline already. And now I'm like, I want to finish it, even though it's spiking the glutamate.
Yeah.
And so I'm like, no, I'm going to finish it and just figure out and just lower my glutamate levels. This is a great experiment. And so that's what I'm doing. But I was like, let me just make sure, because I made 3 or 4 changes. Let me make sure this is from the proline. And so I think it's from a couple things, but I just wanted to make sure that proline was one of the biggest actors. So then I took another 5 grams of proline on top of all the proline I was taking, which was like 50. And then I felt it even stronger. I'm like, okay, it's the proline. Now I know exactly what to do. I'm gonna change my protocol here. But now I know that I'm not going to just take more proline to get the serum proline levels up, right? But also I was trying to see, can I increase collagen production by increasing proline?
Right.
I was also following the Linus Pauling approach to lower lipoprotein A, because there's no really good ways to do it. So I want to see. But in any case, that's an experiment gone wrong. I knew how to fix it. It's okay. Yeah. Now I've taken 3,600 milligrams of NAC, 100 milligrams of P5P, taken some niacin as well, like 300 milligrams. And
add.
I already do. I take 7.5 milligrams.
Okay. Of course you do.
What else do you got? I'm also taking high dose magnesium now.
Which one?
So I'm taking chloride because my chloride levels are consistently low. So not low on the test, but low, like either it's on the lower end of, it's like slightly suboptimal. So I don't want to just include more salt because my sodium is actually good. So I'm just taking more chloride.
Yeah.
So I take potassium chloride and magnesium chloride. So I'm also taking the 3 and 8, but basically, yeah, I'm taking like 7 grams a day of magnesium in different forms. It's less than the elemental.
Have you looked at the magnesium taurinate?
No, I've never taken that, but I take taurine.
Yeah, so magnesium taurinate, that stuff's wild. That will knock your glutamate way down.
Seriously? Wow. Yeah. Is that from the taurine or just some kind of some other mechanism?
I think it's an amplified effect. I don't know what the percent elemental of magnesium taurine or magnesium is in taurinate. It could be just from the taurine. I'm guessing it's probably 20% elemental and magnesium taurinate, probably even 17%. It's low, as most magnesiums are. So then the rest is taurine. But
I'm going to try it out.
Yeah, I noticed a significant, I put that in my optimal sleep 2 formula to help knock glutamate down. That formula was actually to knock down glutamate. And I did have some alpha keto because you do need some alpha keto to knock glutamate down. Too much will, like you say, be problematic. But ammonia will drive increased glutamate levels because ammonia will turn into glutamine in the brain, which then will turn into glutamate. So if you get rid of ammonia, then
my ammonia is already pretty low, though.
Yeah.
I've looked into that.
But if you get rid of ammonia, then you're not going to be storing it in the glutamine.
So I was also taking 6 grams of glutamine, and it turns out that histidine and arginine, like a lot of amino acids actually turn into glutamate when they're metabolized, like in order to get rid of them. So I think the combination of a bunch of amino acids I was taking, but the biggest thing was the proline. And then I started, I did a mega dose of 3,600 milligrams NAC. And I noticed each thing that I did was like really, like the NAC is great for bringing down glutamate. So it was niacin, yeah, so it was
B6.
Yeah. I took them separately. And fish oil is also pretty decent, actually. Magnesium is okay. It doesn't bring it down, but I feel like it just blocks that NMDA receptor. And then increasing serotonin in general lowers the anxiety from glutamate, but I still have a little bit of that. It's like this certain kind of wired. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't like it.
Yeah. Buzz.
Yeah. It's like a buzz or something. And it interferes with sleep a little bit. I had 6 hours last night. So that's like the madman approach. But I do it because, you know, it's just entertaining and I like figuring things out and
testing. And you learn from it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I learned a ton.
Yeah.
My last question is, and you can answer this quickly or however you want. What do you think of all the epigenetic and microbiome tests? Those are the kinds of things that are in like a somewhat similar space.
Yeah.
Like the aging type tests, what's your epigenetic age? Do you buy into those? What's your thoughts on those?
I am intrigued. I'm also scared. I was like, man, I don't want to be hit with brutal honesty, but I feel I'm doing pretty good. I'm 50.
Oh, wow. You look really good.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah.
Some of these biohackers who look really old.
Some of them look very bloated, older. Yeah, they look like they're holding water. Yeah, it's interesting. And so, yeah, I don't live in a bubble. Some of these biohackers live in a bubble.
I'll tell you, I think it's interesting. I've done a few of them. I'm going to do a third one. I'll tell you what it is. It's like an area under the curve test, meaning it'll give you like a snapshot.
I think it's a good snapshot. Like you said, it's an area under the curve, but then it's going to ask the question, okay, if my epigenetic score is 1.3 versus 0.63, then what am I doing wrong? Right.
That's where I think the rest of the lab, you want to take my approach is I do 300 different completely conventional biomarkers, including the amino acids, which I think are actually conventional. I wouldn't consider them functional or anything.
Half of the supplements that I create are for me or my family personally. And because we're a family of five and we have each one of us has a myriad of issues. And I want my kids to survive and thrive. I want my wife to thrive. And it's the latest, I think 8 or 9 supplements have gone to market have all been designed for someone in my family. And it's pretty cool when you think of it that way. And it's something that I don't even tell the public about. I'm starting to, because it's an important thing to share. And it also, I designed it for a very important reason. And it's changed my family's members' life dramatically. And so then I want to go to market and help people. And it took me years to figure it out. Some of them were really fast, but like making dopamine nutrients, that was, I think 10 different formulation changes. The optimal focus, the acetylcholine, that was 13 to 15 different formulation changes over 3 years. And I just kept missing the mark, kept missing. And finally, one day, my kid took it and he came home and was like, Dad, I feel like a genius. I was like, there it is. So Yeah. It's fun having our playground, and you love this stuff. And so you actually designed a company that helps you fulfill a goal of yours and excites you and continues to challenge you. And I did the same thing. I designed a company that challenges me every single day, pushes the limits and supports my family and health-wise and economically. And I think it's really important to have a business that you're super passionate about to challenge you every single day. You don't just go into business to make money. If you do that, you're going to be so unfulfilled. And honestly, I could have retired a long time ago, but I feel I cannot retire because I have so many more questions and I have so many more things I need to fix and resolve and identify and learn about and improve that I have no desire to retire. And I bought books on retirement years ago, and retirement is doing what you want when you want. I was like, well, I'm already retired then.
That's great. No, I love the curiosity, the experimentation, the data-driven, the evidence-oriented. I like your approach to these things. Yeah, I really appreciate you coming on, and it's been a very interesting conversation.
Yeah, likewise, Joe, and hopefully served you or listening and watching.
Super grateful for you coming on, and wish you the best in continuing to help people.
Yeah.
Where can people find your work, by the way?
Instagram at Dr. Ben Lynch when I'm not shadow banned. And I've been, I think the back pressure on that has been they're lifting it a little bit more. Yeah. And seekinghealth.com is a supplement company. The drbenlynch.com, I don't really do much. And then mgfar.net, I don't really do much there anymore. So yeah, seekinghealth.com and at Dr. Ben Lynch on Insta is probably the top two. And I'm starting to get back into doing videos, and I'm going to start my podcast back up again too. So
awesome.
Have you on it at some point on that when I actually get it going. But I'm getting, Seeking Health is undergoing a massive, I walked into the front door last night when I was done with work with my wife, and I told her, I said, I'm rebuilding the entire company right now. She goes, oh gosh. So yeah, it's been a lot, but it's been good. So that's where they can find me.
Awesome. All right. Thanks for coming. Thanks for coming on, and I wish you the best of luck.
Yeah, you too, Joe. Thank you.
67% of listeners aren't following the show, so please don't forget to show your support by hitting the follow button now. You'll not only be supporting the show, but also investing in yourself and your health journey, all while helping to keep us ad-free.